Besides being a prototypical two guard, Klay doesn't have to face a double team every single night. I think he's not the first option, but the most impressive part of that 60 as I watched them was his teammates wanted him to get 80 if he could. That was the most impressive thing.
Rick Bucher. And he was sitting on the bench at one point with KD and Steph during that fourth quarter and said, you know what, man? I thought I could have got 70. And KD looked at him. Steph looked at him and said, dude, you missed like three butt-naked, wide-open three-pointers, and you got your layup blocked a couple times. You should have had 80 points.
This is the B.J. Armstrong and Rick Bucher Show, starring B.J. and Bucher.
All right, welcome to the latest B.J. and Bucher podcast, Four Quarters of Madness. I am Rick Bucher. He is B.J. Armstrong, and we start off the show talking about a rather sad turn of events for the NBA longtime sideline reporter Craig Sager with TNT for several decades. Everybody knew him, knew the dude in the wild suits who seemed to have a rapport with everybody in the NBA, his interactions, interviews with Greg Popovich, in-game interviews became legendary. And he finally, after battling it in a very public way for a couple of years, lost his battle with acute myeloid leukemia. And I'm just wondering, anybody and everybody who was in the NBA, BJ, you came across Craig at some point or other, but I remember distinctly that he was very close to the Bulls during their championship years. That, what was it, Jack Haley and Dennis Rodman and some of the guys, that was, I believe, the second iteration of the championship Bulls. But I'm wondering, was he as prominent or omnipresent during your time with them?
Yeah, Craig was a very interesting character, and what a great person. I knew him professionally. I knew him through this world that I had came into as a 22, 23-year-old kid. And he was always very professional. And the thing that I always appreciated about him as a sideline reporter is how respectful he was of my space as a professional athlete. He never, ever invaded my space without permission. And I always respected that. I respected that about him. And it wasn't just with the star players, where clearly he was always interviewing the star players or the coaches and doing his job. But he was very respectful to everyone that he came in contact with. And for whatever reason, as a young kid, he made an impression on me because he was very respectful to me when he didn't have to be. And he always had kind words for me, and he was always encouraging me to, explore and do things. And I just remember I was like, he didn't know me from Man in the Moon. I had seen him on television, and he would always, every time he would see me, whether it was during the game or, out and about, in our everyday life, he would always take time, and he'd always had something positive and encouraging to say. And I always respected that about him. And I'll always remember, even when I was seeing him in the last year or so, he always had something positive to say. And he will be dearly missed. He was a great colleague and very well respected in the business.
That was one of the things that I think people didn't recognize or fully appreciate. And it took me a while to appreciate it too. Because of the suits, because of somewhat what I thought was showmanship, he was a pro. Respecting that space, the way he went about his job, and it's a tricky, being a sideline reporter, you're not full-on reporter, you're not full-on TV guy, you kind of have to bridge this gap, and he did that extremely well. Let's move on to the news in the first quarter. The NBA, perhaps you've heard, BJ, the NBA has announced that they have reached an agreement on a new collective bargaining agreement.
Yes.
Labor peace is here.
Yes.
We don't know all the details of it.
No, we don't.
Some of them have been leaked out, but we have not seen a complete agreement and what it includes. I've heard that it's not completed quite yet. So I'll start here. How do we have an agreement? How do we reach a tentative agreement when the parties at hand, meaning the players, certainly, have not seen the document that they are supposedly approving of that is going to determine their future for the next 5-6 years?
Well, I look at this sometime as an ex-player. I look at it now as an agent. I've looked at it as an executive. I look at it as a fan. I try to even incorporate what it would look like as an owner. And here's what I'll say about the collective bargaining agreement. No, we don't know the details. So it's unfair for us to, you know, come out and say it's a good deal or bad deal. What I will say is there have been some good aspects about things that have happened in this CBA. There have been some good things that have occurred.
Like what?
Like, for instance,
the expanded health coverage.
I'm not talking to this specific one. I'm talking about things that have encouraged, you know, players, the percentages, the money that players were participating in the BRI. Players suddenly having an opportunity with free agency and the so forth. All the things that have transpired that have led and gotten us to where it's currently at.
That's not my problem here. My problem is that we don't have a deal ratified, that we don't have all the details of this new agreement. But somehow, some way, the owners and the players have reached a rather peaceful, non-eventful, uneventful term to come to an agreement on how they're going to spend the next 5 years. And I just think about what happened the last time around in the last agreement, which I thought was basically the owners strong-armed the players, and they cried poor to do so. Well, now, when you got Steve Ballmer buying in a franchise for $2 billion, when you have franchises left and right, people fighting over the opportunity to buy a franchise, you see the money that is being made. You see the TV contracts that are being signed. You see the ancillary business deals that are being made by the NBA. They can't cry poor anymore. This is the opportunity for the players, for the first time, to win in the court of public opinion and to say, we've been getting roost this entire time. And it would appear, like you said, we don't know all the details.
Yes.
But it would appear that the players did not fight that fight, that they did not try to reset the table for where it belongs, that there, it's go along, get along. And so I don't begrudge the owners for doing what they're doing. And I don't have a tremendous amount of sympathy for the players in that, looking at the deal that they're getting, that they're not making all the money that they could. And I'm disappointed that they didn't try.
How can we say we're disappointed when we don't know what we're disappointed in?
I can tell you what we're disappointed in. I'm disappointed in that the players in this league are the driving force of what makes this a billion-dollar industry.
Yes.
And the players were the driving force the last time around. And they got the owners outfoxed them every which way when it comes to how much money they are getting and how much they deserve to get. And there's no, look, I'm talking into an echo chamber, because fans out there, they don't care. They look at the numbers. They look at the millions the players are making. There is no sympathy there.
Right.
But I just look at it. What's fair is fair. I want people to get paid what they deserve to get paid because of what they produce. And as much as the players might be making, and as great as that might seem to the average fan, they're not making as much as they deserve based on their value and importance to the NBA. And on the flip side, the owners make the lion's share of the money when it comes to the NBA. And yeah, I may be that idiot who just stands on a soapbox and wants things to be fair and wants things to be right. And you can say, BJ, the world doesn't work that way. But in this case, when I look at players, I feel like they're being done a disservice, and they're doing a disservice to themselves. It disappoints me because I don't want the world to work that way.
Again, in being in this business and dealing with this business for quite some time, you know, I want to see what was negotiated so that I can make a fair assessment of all of the things that were going on, not just what was reported. I can't buy into that one, because in the end, I have to get to the facts of the deal. The facts of the deal is that whether or not who's getting what share and whatever share in revenue it is, the league, I think we all can agree, is continuing to grow.
Is the part that the players are getting, is it growing in concert with the league, the way the league's growing?
The thing that's hard to keep tabs on is the calculations as the BRI, as they continue to find other sources of revenue. You know, this league at one point was a domestic, you know, league. Now, this is a true international business. So how are we going to continue to calculate all of those as we continue to grow yearly in this league? Some 25 years ago, we were a network, you know, league where we're just on the major networks. Now we're on cable. Now we're a satellite. Now we're on computers and tablets and iPhones.
Yeah, you're being streamed.
So, yeah, we're being streamed. So now we have to continue to grow. Now, the one thing that I will continue to say is that we know that the league is continuing to grow the pot. We know that the bottom line for everyone involved is everyone is continuing to generate revenue. So without me seeing everything and reading it for myself and being able to ask questions, I won't be able to really give you my formal opinion.
You can walk the line and say, I need to see everything before I render my decision. And look, that's very mature of you. That's the way to go.
Here's what we're going to do. As soon as the deal is released, you and I and a labor lawyer are going to get on the show, and we're going to dedicate the entire show so that we can talk about the specifics of the deal. So that way we can make...
Can't wait to get you and a lawyer and some single typed pages together to do a podcast. Last 2 minute report. This involves the NBA referees. There was a no call in the Pelicans Warriors game in New Orleans. Dubs ended up winning 113-109. Here's the scene. So Draymond Green, your client, stole the ball from Anthony Davis, another one of your clients, in the post, and AD complained that he was fouled. So when the league went back and reviewed the game afterward, because a foul was not called in that situation, the league released their last 2 minute report, and they said that the refs got that call wrong. The NBA referees, and this is kind of new, I didn't even know that they spoke out and said, screw you, league office. No, you got it wrong. Now we got a pissing match between the referees and headquarters in New York.
Oh man.
They're saying that no, the league office is wrong. The contact that Draymond made on AD was incidental. We only have like 3 minutes to discuss this, and we need probably an hour.
Yeah, we do.
Because this thing is so chock full of different angles. But did you watch the game?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. Yes, I did.
And what is your thought about that play? What happened? Was it a foul?
Well, here was my thought. Here was my thought.
Can
I just have my thought? Can I have my opinion?
Just tell me yes or no. Was it a foul?
Here's my opinion.
Was it a foul?
Can I get to that?
No. Yes. Tell me, was it a foul?
So here is my view of this situation.
Here we go.
There was an unwritten rule in the NBA where the players determined the outcome of the game.
Hold on. Can we get some music? It's story time with BJ. Okay.
Was that a foul? No, that wasn't a foul.
Okay.
That was not a foul.
No, was that so hard?
No, but you know, you got to put it in its proper context. In the last minutes of a game like that, the player should determine the outcome of the game. The player should determine that. And I thought in that instance, the players determined the outcome of the game.
Right.
I don't think one player had an advantage. It was 1-on-1, mano a mano. And, you know what? Draymond made a great defensive play. Simple as that. He made a great defensive play, and I did not see a foul on the play. Now, you can argue it. You have the benefit of looking in on a replay and all those things and looking at it from the 20 different angles or whatever. That was not a foul from what I could see, because the players should determine the outcome of a game.
All right. We're going to the second quarter. Let's go to the whole idea. We're in the second quarter. Superstar bench warmers is how our producer Shane Freeman tagged them. But it's essentially the idea, and this is spurred by the Cavs the other night. They beat Memphis at home, and then they went to Memphis, and I'm not even sure they brought LeBron, Kyrie, and Kevin Love along, but they certainly did not play those guys. How do you feel? And we've talked about this, about being smarter in, you wish you'd been smarter in taking care of your body during your career. But this does get into the, like, where and when you rest guys and why you rest them. Do you have an answer as to how we do this and make it palatable for the fan?
Well, as an ex-player, based on what I knew as a player back then in the 80s, 90s, you played if you could play.
Right.
We weren't aware of all of the medical things and studies that we have then as we are now. So I felt then an enormous responsibility to play basically under any condition. As long as I could walk, I could figure out how to run, I could play.
How much of that was because you had just been grown, you had been brought up to think that way, and how much of it was, I don't want to lose my job. Like, I don't want to lose my standing.
You know, that was just the environment that I was in. You know, my parents, I saw my parents do it. They went to work. If you could get up, yeah, you could work. So that was the mentality that I have. I didn't have access to all of the information that these kids have today. In knowing what I know now, if I could go back, I would do it differently, because clearly that is not the best thing for you long term. So I go back and forth because I don't have an answer, but I am very sensitive to that person who may only get one time in their entire life to see a LeBron James,
right,
and to see a Michael Jordan, or to see that star player who they've always, and then suddenly they can't play. So I don't have an answer, but what I will say about this is that I think there's a fine line in here somewhere, because clearly these kids, these players are playing the game and giving their all. But as you can see, just because you can play doesn't mean that that's the right thing for you to do long term. And so I'm very sensitive to the bodies of these young men, but I'm also sensitive to the fact that, you know what? God, these people pay a lot of money to come see you play. And if you can play, I want to be able to give them that opportunity. So I don't have an answer right now, because I see both sides of the equation.
I respect that perspective. But here's my thing, right? I'm a fan.
Yeah.
All right. I'm the guy who paid for my entire family to go to a game, and I work a day job. All right. And I'm looking like, hell, I work construction. Right. So if I work construction,
yeah,
and I go to work every day and I'm out in the hot sun, and they're pouring asphalt and concrete, so it's 300 degrees where I'm standing at, and I'm out there in traffic, playing in traffic, dodging cars, that doesn't give me a pass to not do my job. Like, right, I understand that players get hurt and they get injured, and I don't advocate anybody working when they're sick or working when they're in bad shape. I totally get that. But when you can't tell a guy who works every day out in 300-degree weather and just spent $200-$300, which is a lot to him and his family, right, and his kids are sitting there like, where's LeBron? You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Like, look, that's tough. That's a tough situation.
But here's the thing. Here's the difference. Here's the difference. I agree what you're saying, but also the player's perspective. If a player's body is off balance in one place, he begins to compensate.
Right. I agree with that.
All right, a kid may have a toe injury. Okay, I can't push off on my right toe. You're still going to generate the same amount of force, but now where is it going to compensate? Why you compensating puts you at greater risk to have a substantial injury that would career-ending injury, because you're trying to do something that we know puts you at danger and at risk. A kid like LeBron James, that kid is 6'8", 270-some pounds. He's generating force that none of us really can comprehend and understand. And if that body or that machine isn't lined up correctly,
sure,
well, he could really mess something up.
Right.
So I just want to be sensitive to everyone involved, because again, you do not want to put anyone at risk that there is no need to put at risk.
Our understanding of physical kinetics are greater than they've ever
Absolutely.
Been. And so we're there. It's preventive decisions that are being made.
Yes.
Not with knowledge. I get all that. And so, and there's also more money. I mean, these guys are paid more money. There's more money at stake. They're more conscious of the value of a guy playing a certain number of games versus not playing, or, you know, how you can bridge that gap. We're more finely tuned when it comes to that. Here's my question, and I don't know if you can answer this being an executive, and we'll move on after this. Is when you're a team like the Memphis Grizzlies and you sell a game for LeBron and Kyrie and Kevin Love, when you have a marquee team coming in, how much does that change the gate versus, say, like in this situation, have Kevin Love, have Kyrie, and have LeBron sit out the game at home, because chances are those fans are going to have more opportunities to see those three guys. But this is the one time all year that Memphis gets to see those stars, gets to see the defending champions at full strength. When you have a big ticket team come in, it has a big impact on your gate, big enough that you feel it when those guys either don't show up or now people are leery about buying tickets for them.
The real question to me is the risk of the health of the players. And I think that's a very legit question that we have to continue to examine and try to come up with an answer.
All right. Well, I don't want either one of us to pull a vocal cord, so we are going to take a halftime break. We're going to provide some musical entertainment. We're going to suck on a lozenge, maybe gargle a little bit. Anyway, get ready and be prepared for the third quarter, because you know what the third quarter is all about. Oh, yeah.
What are you doing? It's just a halftime.
Yes, this is my favorite part of the game.
All right, guys, this is Shane at the Halftime Break on the BJ and Bucher podcast. And today's halftime entertainment is provided by Run DMC, and this is their song, Christmas in Hollis. Happy holidays to you guys from BJ and Bucher podcast.
Quarters of Madness, it is trivia time. And before we get started, I need to ask a question, because I'm reading in the show notes here, the person with the least number of correct answers will have a GIF meme of themselves tweeted and must retweet and share the image.
Didn't I do that?
When I lost the first week, yeah, when right. I lost the first week, I dutifully sent that out, even though it showed you hitting me with a haymaker and me going down, losing a tooth and getting a black eye. I was humiliated. But I tweeted it out because that's the rules of the game and because Shane made a funny GIF. Now, the last 2 weeks, I have won. And the GIF was all about me jacking you up.
Oh, wow.
And you have not retweeted. You have not acknowledged those GIF memes. Don't swear about anything.
I have to really examine
what
and go back and look at that. But that's fair. It's a fair assessment.
What do you mean it's fair? Yeah, it's a fair assessment. I know it's fair. What's not fair is that you're not following the rules.
You're absolutely. You're, you know what? I will have to look at that. Yeah.
Don't patronize me. Just answer this question.
Okay. Here we go.
Which team has the most NBA Finals losses ever? The Lakers, the Knicks, the 76ers, or the Boston Celtics?
Lakers.
That is correct. They've lost a total of 15 NBA Finals. All right, what do you have for me?
Okay, here we go.
I should be doing this under protest, but...
Which team was the last to lose back-to-back NBA Finals?
The last team, the Buffalo Bills.
It's similar to the Buffalo Bills.
Does that count? I know. The Utah Jazz.
The New Jersey Nets.
That's right. Damn it. You get multiple options and I don't.
Hey,
damn
look,
it.
Do you know what two teams they actually lost back to back to, Rick?
The Spurs.
The Spurs and one of and somebody else.
And the other one, trying to think who was in that mix then. Lakers?
Yep. No. Spurs and the Lakers.
The Lakers Nets?
Yeah,
oh, that's right. Which two teams share the NBA's all-time longest losing streak? Cleveland Cavaliers, Los Angeles Clippers, Philadelphia 76ers, and or the Orlando Magic?
76ers.
No, you got to have two teams. Which teams? Two teams. There are two teams that share the NBA's all-time longest losing streak. So you have to pick two of those four. Cavaliers, Clippers, 76ers, Magic.
I'm going to say the Clippers and the Sixers.
Clippers and the Sixers, that would be incorrect. It is the 76ers, you were right on that, and the Cleveland Cavaliers. And I believe that was the year after LeBron left, when not only he left, but they had like a slew of injuries too.
So do I get a half a point for that?
No, you don't.
How could
you're asking for benefits? You don't even do what we say we're going to do, and now you want compensation?
I should get half of a...
You should get nothing. You should have been banned from participating. This should be a contest between Shane and myself, because I know that Shane would at least put out a tweet that he's supposed to tweet put out.
I'm getting caught up. All right, here's the go. This team holds the NBA crown for the worst team ever to play an 82-game season. A, the 1987 LA Clippers. B, the 1973 Philadelphia 76ers. C, the 2016 Philadelphia 76ers. Or D, the 1993 Dallas Mavericks.
You're going to have to give me that whole thing over again because I was totally distracted. I was trying to think of the black philosopher that you remind me of with your facial hair. It's Dick Gregory.
You know,
that's who
Dick,
you
no,
that's
Dick Gregory.
Your neck beard.
He's my favorite. I appreciate that. I appreciate that. Okay.
Yeah.
But here's
so
you, here. Yeah,
so excuse me, Mr. Gregory,
yes.
Could you repeat the question?
Yes, I can. This team holds the NBA crown for the worst team ever to play an 82-game season. The 87 Clippers, the 73 76ers, the 2016 76ers, or the 1993 Dallas Mavericks.
Who were the two? I'm sorry, give me the two Sixers teams.
The 73 Sixers or the 16 Sixers.
2016 Sixers or the 73 Sixers?
Yep.
It's the 73 Sixers.
Yes, you are correct.
Yeah,
they were
9-73
that year.
And once again, we are going to overtime.
This is where,
and you know,
every week we go to overtime.
And you know who owns overtime? This guy.
I think that's my protest. We go to overtime. Okay, all right, let's go, Shane.
All right.
Hey, get two right, and then you got no complaint because I don't think I've gotten two right.
I know.
Yet.
All right, Jeopardy rules again, fellas. First person to answer correctly wins. All right, the NBA has had how many Game 7s in playoff history? A, 123.
Oh, my God.
B, 125. C, 127. Or D, 129.
You know what?
This is a total.
Exactly.
This is a total stab in the dark.
Okay.
That's the whole point.
127.
125.
Ding, 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 125? Man, BJ, you got the answer right on the first one.
Hey. Wait a minute. Does that mean that I get to I get the gift this
week?
Yeah,
you do. And you know what that means? That means I get to not tweet it out. Because I forgot. Or let me review my Twitter handle because I'm not quite aware whether somebody actually activated that or not.
Please respect your elders. Mr. Gregory requires that you respect your elders here, okay?
Dick Gregory on Twitter. That's what I would have liked to have seen.
Dick Gregory on Twitter.
Wow. Okay. Right. So, yeah, whatever. Let's move on to the fourth quarter. All right, it's the fourth quarter where who knows where we're going to go. Sometimes we have a guest. Sometimes we just decide to spill the beans on something that's hot and interesting in the league. And today's randomonium topic is the relationship or lack thereof between two guys who were fast friends once upon a time, Charles Barkley and Michael Jordan. Since Charles criticized Michael Jordan and his ownership of the Charlotte franchise, once upon a time the Bobcats, then the Hornets, now the Hornets, their relationship has been broken. And Kenny Smith just came out recently and said that Charles owes Michael an apology. I just wonder, going back to when Charles Oakley, a longtime fast friend of Michael Jordan, but not a friend of Charles Barkley's at all. So how did it end up that Michael Jordan and Charles Barkley became friends when Oak, one of Michael's staunch friends, couldn't stand Charles?
Well, I don't know how it works in your world, but I mean, you can be friends with you know, different people. You have different relationships. You know, clearly Oakley and Michael had a relationship.
Yeah, but they were boys. And it seemed like Michael and Charles were boys, too.
Well, let's look at it. You know, Oakley and Michael played together.
Yeah.
At the early part of his career. Charles Barkley and Michael, I'm sure, met, you know, they're around the same age. But more importantly, they were together at Nike for many years. And I'm sure they did a lot of promotional things together and were part of the Nike family. So he got an opportunity to spend a lot of times with him through the course of, you know, collegiate basketball, along with, you know, knowing him professionally through his, you know, extended family with Nike. So I could see the possibility of having relationship. The thing that was odd was those two didn't like each other. And clearly over the years, there was no love lost between the two. As you can see over the years, anyone who was watching basketball back then knew that those two were going to get in some type of altercation every time they saw each other on the floor.
What do you think was at the heart of there? Because I look at them and I think they're two very different personalities. They had two very different games. What do you think was at the heart of their dislike for each other?
Well, knowing both of them like I do, neither one of them was going to back away from the physicality of the game. The game was played much different. Both of those guys were big, strong, and athletic. And in that time, in that era, there was a lot of intimidation involved. Anyone that knows Oakley isn't turning down anything. I've never seen the man even turn down his collar on his shirt. He is not backing away from anything. Okay. Charles is a, you know, Charles was an aggressive player. I mean, he played the game at like a controlled rage. You know, Charles Barkley was rumbling and stumbling. And I mean, that was a big body coming at you full speed. And I can vividly remember, you know, when you saw him running down the court, you didn't think about trying to get in his way to take a charge. Mm. But that was a big man running and he would, you know, you could get hurt.
Yeah.
I mean, he played the game with that type of force and pace early in his career. Those two together, the way they played, being very prideful, you know, they're very prideful men. If you know them, neither one of them is going to back away from a fight. And I just think it was just competition that just continued to escalate to where neither one of them, I mean, if those two are in the room today, I'm getting out of that room because those are some big men. And it's just a different time and a different era. But it was, I think it all stem from competition, but it's just one where neither one of them are willing to let it go. I mean, and I think that's just where the game was played back then, and that's where it's at. So I can see how they could be, you know, friends with Michael. You know, but at the same time, I mean, it was just a very competitive environment that those guys played in. And that's the way it was back then.
Well, and because look, things are said, things are criticized. Michael knows the role that Charles has. Why would that be something that would end their friendship? A friendship that, by all appearances, lasted for decades.
Well, I think you said it. You have to recognize where people are at in their life. Charles could say things as a player that no one else could get away with. Charles says things as a commentator that no other commentator can get away with. Okay.
Charles
is, he's carved out a very unique niche for himself. Mm-hmm. The things you can say to players that we said to each other, if I said to just a colleague of mine at work, it would be some of the things I would be, it would be very offensive to that person. So the things you can say to another player, which Michael and Charles were probably funny back then, and they were funny to all of us. But again, I think Michael has respected where Charles is at in his life, in his career. He's on television. That's his job. Mm-hmm. But now you have I think Charles didn't reciprocate the same. And I don't think Charles gave him the same respect, if you will, that say that, you know, this isn't Michael Jordan, the player anymore. This isn't Michael Jordan, the pitchman anymore. This is Michael Jordan, the owner. And there's a fine line in there. I think it's okay for Charles in his job to make his fair assessment. But there's a line, too, that you just say, you know what, you can't cross. So I think Michael felt, and I don't know this, but in knowing Michael the way I do, I think he felt that Charles crossed that line. And when you cross that line with him... That's it. And so I think that's where it's at.
That's it.
And I think it's really a part of those guys they have too much history to not talk it through. But at the same time, I think Charles has to be the bigger person here and say, you know what? I did cross that line because they're good friends.
Fair enough. All right. So apology in order. We'll have Charles on and see if he wants to convey that.
Yes, we should have Charles. We should have Charles on and just dedicate the entire four quarters from him because
that's how it ends up in. We don't need a rundown because Charles will end up taking it wherever Charles decides it should ultimately go. You know, I've said some things to you on this podcast, BJ, that I don't know that I could say to the normal person or I could say to, you know, a BR colleague or whomever, but that's the kind of relationship we have. And I know that you take it the way it's intended. And as soon as you get those two tweets out that you owe me, then you'll get mine for having won the trivia today. And until then, screw you, BJ Armstrong.
Oh.
All right. For those of you who'd like to tell us something, you can always subscribe to iTunes. Make sure you're not going to miss a single podcast. Subscribe to the show. Rate and leave a message, a review. We do love to hear what you have to think. And also check out our brand new website, bjandbuecher.com. We're going to have a lot of content there, not just the podcast. We're going to have some writers working for us. I'm going to pen a couple things and put them there.
Oh, wow.
Who knows?
Oh,
BJ may even grace us with something that he's thought of.
Oh, yeah.
Or maybe some photos, maybe some his photography collection. I don't know if you guys know this. I'm just making this up now. I was going to say like some world-class photographer or something. Do you ever use a photo? What is your hobby?
Harassing Rick Bucher.
There you go.
That's my hobby.
Well, tune in next week and you'll hear more of the same. This has been the BJ and Bucher podcast, Four Quarters of Madness.